bread, I'll accept that invitation to tell that story. It's a great privilege, and we're thankful, those of us who are here in this congregation, we're thankful for those of you who are visiting with us or who are new. We want to make sure that all of you who are new have someone to greet you and meet you after we're dismissed. There's a whole slew of them right in here I saw just a moment ago, but they're probably scattered throughout the audience. Would you please, after we're dismissed, check through the congregation and see somebody that looks queer or strange. Check for somebody that looks like a stranger and be sure to meet them because we want to know you and we want to welcome you. We want you to be a part of us for this whole coming year. We have a lot of good times together, assembling as Christians and worshiping and enjoying being Christians. There's nothing greater than being a Christian, a follower of Jesus Christ, and it has no bite in it. There's no kick in it as far as an after bite. Everything there is sweet and rewarding, and there are no dregs in the bottom of the cup. Brother Ollery, did you mention this morning that the elders are requesting that we increase 20% for just these first two Sundays or for the five or for the remaining seven? For the remaining seven. All right, I was a bit undecided as to what you meant. The elders are requesting that we increase our contribution about 20%. For the next seven Sundays, and I'm sure that we can do that, especially if our young people kick in and we all join hands in this effort. We're going to be a bit late getting started. Bear with me. I want to tell you a few things about the last 18 hours of the Lord's life. In our studies on Sunday morning, to bring up to date those of you who are new with us tonight, we've been studying out of Matthew, the 6th chapter, in an effort to hone us, polish us, purge us, and further prepare us for an expanded mission or an expanded ministry as we as Christians begin perfecting ourselves and cleansing ourselves from all that's ignoble. And so we've been studying out of Matthew 6 for that extended preparation for an expanded ministry. Then on Sunday evenings, we've been studying out of the last 18 hours of the Lord's life, taken primarily from the 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, and 17th chapters of the book of John. That only covers about 18 hours. And we've been investigating those last 18 hours for the purpose of seeing if we can find a correlation between his actual actions and his words and his attitudes in those last 18 hours, a correlation between that and the teachings that he did in his earlier ministry. What we're looking for is not just a correlation. What I was looking for is a corroboration, a substantiation, so that one we find would back up the other. You know, Jesus was always just spot on. He never taught one thing and did something else. But we came to the 18 hours just preceding his death with the assumption that if there ever were a time in a man's life when he would back off of what he had said earlier, it would be during the time that he was facing death. And so we've come to that study looking for a corroboration. You know, a ship is built in a shipyard, but it's not tested until it's put out on the seas. Jesus' teaching in his early ministry has a ring about it that is eternal and true. And we're now seeing that in the last 18 hours of his life, we're finding a corroboration of what he had said earlier. We're finding it substantiated in what he did. We observed on Sunday mornings that there is one major theme running throughout the 6th chapter of the book of Matthew, and that is that we're to live our lives in constant awareness of the presence and power of God. The first 18 verses of that 6th chapter talk about our religious life, our piety. It talks about the way we give and the way we pray and the way we exercise self-discipline in our lives. And all three of these areas, which cover our entire relationship to God, to ourselves, and to others, in our development of an inner piety, all three of these areas are to be done in the presence of God, not in the presence of people. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't do them with anybody. It just simply means, as Jesus says, you're not to pray or give or exercise self-discipline to be seen by anybody other than God. That you're to pray in secret so that he who sees in secret will reward you. You're to give without blowing a trumpet, so that he who sees you in secret, he'll reward you openly. And you're to exercise self-discipline, not before other people, to be seen by them, but to be seen by your Father. And then verses 19 through 34 says that in our life in the world, in the secular world, it is also to be lived in the presence and the power of God, in the awareness of his care for us, to the extent that we're not to lay up treasures on earth, but to lay up treasures in heaven, and that we are not to be anxious about physical things, but to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to us as well, because he knows that you need these things. But this whole overall theme of Matthew, the sixth chapter, is that we, as followers of Jesus Christ, are to live our lives in constant awareness of the presence and under the power of God. Now, the question for tonight is simply this. Do we find a corroboration? Do we find a substantiation of that? Do we find evidence that this existed in the life of Jesus Christ during these last 18 hours of his life? And, of course, the answer is yes. It's an unqualified, unreserved yes. Jesus of Nazareth, if there was any one thing about his life that you can pinpoint and say this was the central theme of his life, it would be this. Jesus Christ lived his life totally aware of the presence and the constant awareness of the power of God. There was no other thing that was so much a part of his life as was this awareness of the presence of his Father. From Luke, the second chapter, in verse 49, where Luke records that at 12 years of age, his mother and father came back to Jerusalem and found him in the temple, sitting and questioning and answering these scribes and Pharisees, where he said, I must be about my Father's business. From that point, at the 12th year of his life, until the 33rd, I guess, year of his life, when he was hanging upon the cross and prayed, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. From that point, at 12 years, at least until he died, there was no other concept that was so all-pervasive or so completely infiltrating into the life and consciousness of Jesus than was this awareness that his Father was the prime subject or the prime object, I'm not sure what you would say, of his thinking. And here in the 14th chapter of John, verse 2, Jesus uses for the first time what must have been the very chief and central theme or concept or thought of his entire existence. And it's this beautiful expression, my Father, my Father. Now he uses it 50 times in four chapters. Chapters 14, 15, 16, and 17, he uses this expression, my Father, or the Father, 50 times. And this covered an expanse of perhaps 4 or 5 hours at the most. So 50 times in 5 hours, he brings up the subject of his Father. Now, all I've done for tonight is simply analyze those 50 occasions or those 50 incidents. Now, I'm not going to mention all of them tonight. I've analyzed them and found out how they are categorized and how they fall out into an outline, more or less. And I've found 4 outstanding qualities of this awareness of God and how it fit into the life of Jesus, or how his life fit into these categories. And they're very beautiful. And for 2 reasons, I mention them tonight. Number 1, I find in them a corroboration of what he taught throughout the past 3 years of his personal ministry. Now, I keep using that word corroboration. A substantiation, a backing up, a validating, that's good enough. You can get one of those words. I want to find out if there's not some way that you can see in action what Jesus Christ taught that we ought to be in fact. What he taught, I want us to see if he was doing it so that we also can get a clear message. So for 2 reasons, I'm mentioning this to you tonight. Number 1, I want you to see Jesus' own teaching substantiated by his life when he was under pressure. And secondly, I want us to see that in this, there is a very clear course charted for you and me if we would be successful ministers of Jesus Christ. And I'm using the term minister in all of this, not in the term of which I'm usually called a minister. I'm talking about every last one of us as being ministers of Jesus Christ. We're all his ministers in one sense or another. Now, in these 50 occasions, there are 4 outstanding themes that we gather and we glean from these 50 occasions. Number 1, we find, first of all, and it's basic to all the rest of these, that Jesus, in his use of the Father or my Father 50 times, he speaks of his identity with the Father, this relationship that he had to his Father. This is the way he begins in chapter 13 and verse 3. Listen to this statement. And during the supper, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God. Now, you don't get anything more than past, present, and future. He came from God, that's past. God had committed all things present into his hands, and then into the future, he was going back to God. So he worked off of this premise of his relationship with his Father. Now, based on that, watch some of the things that came out of it. In chapter 14, in verse 2, he relates just how personally and intimately he was associated with the house of his Father. For example, he knew the layout. He knew where it was. He knew the location. He knew the number of rooms in it. He knew everything about it. The writer of Hebrews speaks of Jesus as being a son who was faithful over the Father's house. Now, he says we are that house. But John talks about him in turn and records these statements by Jesus. I'm convinced that this man, Jesus, was not talking about something that was a nebulous thing way out yonder that he was just speculating about. Do you know how I believe, what I believe about this? I believe he was talking from personal experience. He had been there. He wasn't saying in my Father's house are many mansions like I would say that. He was talking about a place where he had been in times past and was now away from, and he was now trying to get across to these men, I know where I'm going. And in my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not true, I wouldn't have told you that I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place, I'm going to come and receive you again to myself. He had this intimate acquaintance with the location, with the layout, with the number of rooms, with the whole shebang. He knew everything about it, and it was from past experience. And then look again. The second thing about it was he felt perfectly free to invite anybody home with him that he wanted to. Now in verse 2 of this 14th chapter, he says, if it were not true, I would not have told you that I'm coming again to receive you to myself. He says, I've gone to prepare a place for you. I'm going to make a bedroom for you. I'm going to get a room ready. You come on. You can come later. You can't come now, but you can come later. And he also felt free not only to invite the 12 or the 11 at this point, but he also felt free to invite the thief on the cross when the thief said, remember me when you come in your kingdom. Jesus didn't hesitate to say, Father, he didn't hesitate to say to the thief, today you're going to be with me in paradise. He did tell his Father, incidentally, in his prayer in John 17 that he was bringing these men home with him, and that helps. A lot of times kids just show up, you know, with all these stragglers with them from school or wherever. The other day I came into the house, and there was a man sitting at my table. I never had seen him before, but one of my boys had said, you can have my bed for the night. This man had brought his daughter to school, and so the boy said, well, you can have my bed. Louie laughed and said, well, what he didn't realize was that some other stranger was already in his bed. But that's all right. I couldn't turn him down because this man was a friend of my son. And this man here, Jesus, had all these friends that he wanted to bring home with him, and he felt just that personally associated and acquainted with his Father that he knew how many rooms his Father had. He said, come on, I want you to go home with me. And in the 17th verse of the 17th chapter, he says, Father, I want these men also, whom thou hast given me, to be with me where I am, to behold my glory, which thou hast given me in thy love for me before the foundation of the world. So Jesus had this very intimate association with his Father. In chapter 14 and verse 6, he claims to be the way home. He says, in other words, if you don't come through me, you don't get to stay with my Father. He said, I am the way, I am the truth and the light. No man can come to the Father but by me. In other words, he said, I've got the tickets, more or less. I'm the one that's arranging for the accommodations, and if you don't come through me, you won't get a room. You better make your reservations through me. That's what he was telling them. And then he goes so far as to simply say, the Father and I are so much alike. In fact, he says, we are. When Philip said, show us the Father and we'll be satisfied, he kept talking about the Father, the Father, the Father. Philip kind of said, well, Lord, show us the Father and we'll be satisfied. Then Jesus came, and I've quoted this to you so many times, but I can't get over the impact of it. Jesus said, Philip, have I been with you this long and you don't even recognize me? He claimed to be the Father, or so nearly the Father. He said that if you've seen me, you've seen my Father. He said, how do you say, show us the Father? Don't you know that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? So he showed this beautiful, intimate relationship that he had with his father. But all right, but there's a second thing. Not only did he have this relationship, our identity with his father, but he showed this love for his father. Now this permeates the entire four or five chapters here, this love that he had for his father. And yet he only mentions it one time. I was surprised. I suspected it. But I thought when I was doing this investigation, I thought, well, now I'll surely run across this proclamation of his love for his father over and over and over again. But I didn't find it. I only found it one time. And that's found in the 14th chapter where he says here, I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming. He has no power over me, but I do as the Father has commanded me so that the world may know that I love the Father. And he associates it with his death on the cross. And he simply says, I am doing what my Father has commanded me because so that the world may know that I love the Father. But that's the only time it's mentioned. Now it is mentioned repeatedly, his awareness of his father's love for him, that's mentioned repeatedly. Notice in chapter 15, verses 9 and 10, he makes this statement, as the Father has loved me, so I've loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you'll abide in my love, just as I have kept the Father's commandments and I abide in his love. And then in chapter 17, verses 23, 24, and 26, he makes this statement, in them, I in them, and thou in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved them even as thou hast loved me. Father, I desire that they also whom thou hast given me may be with me where I am to behold my glory, which thou hast given me in thy love for me before the foundation of the world. And then the last verse of that chapter, I made known to them thy name, and I will make it known that the love with which thou hast loved me may be in them and I in them. You see, he never doubted the love that his father had for him. He didn't say too much about it as far as professing it. But I tell you what he did do. You can see in everything that he did, you can see this love that he had for his father. You can see it all the way through his former life. You can see it as it permeates these five chapters here. For this reason here, if for no other reason, he was always talking about his daddy. Always talking about his father. And you know that says a lot. That says a lot. Some of these guys drive me up the wall talking about this little girl they're in love with. Always talking about her. Always writing about her. Never can bring up anything but what it doesn't remind them of her. There was one that just literally, I don't know whether you're here or not. Bill, you here? He nearly drove me up the wall this summer. Moping around, he's going to get married. He got married. He's not here. He got married just last week. That's right. Thank the Lord. I'm so glad he made it. I didn't think he's going to. But he kept moping around wanting to see that gal. I said, Bill, go on and marry her. Go on and get her. You're going to drive yourself crazy. I said, either do that or get her off your mind and get her off of my mind. But I knew he loved her by the way he kept talking about her constantly. Jesus of Nazareth kept talking about his father, how he must have loved him. But there's a third thing, and that is that he showed his dependence upon his father. Now this also is one of the major themes of these five chapters. He showed his relationship to his father, intimate, meaningful, warm, deep, rewarding. Secondly, he showed his love for his father and was aware of his father's love for him. But then thirdly, he showed here a total dependence upon his father. In the fifth chapter of John, verses 19 and 30, he makes the statement, I can do nothing of myself. That's an odd statement. And I'm not going to dwell on it, but he just simply says, I can of myself do nothing. And verse 30, he says, I can do nothing on my own authority. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just because I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. But he was just simply saying, I can't do anything of myself. He makes a similar statement to that in the 14th chapter of John. And verse 10, where he says almost identically the same thing, do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. He says the same thing in chapter 12 in verse 49 and 50. For I have not spoken on my own authority. The Father who sent me has himself given me commandment what to speak, in one translation says, and how to speak it. What to say and how to say it. Well, you don't get any more dependent on somebody than for them to say, here, this is what you're supposed to say, and let me tell you now how to say it. And he didn't make any bones about it. He says, that's the relationship that I have with my father. I'm totally dependent upon him. And then in the 15th chapter, Brett, you led a song tonight that was the very verse or the very chapter, I am the vine and you are the branches. But the relationship that he sustains to his Father, he says in verse 1 of chapter 15, I am the vine and you, my Father is the husbandman. He's the one that feeds me. He's the one that planted me, that trains me, that feeds me, that prunes me. He's the one that fertilizes me. He does all of this for me. I am the vine. My Father is the husbandman. You're the branches, he says. So he shows this dependence that he has upon his Father. And then in the 14th chapter in verse 28, he says, the Father is greater than I am. So there's no doubt about it. This idea runs all the way through the teachings of Jesus. And this is one of the most profound and one of the most pronounced acknowledgments in all the New Testament as far as the life of Jesus is concerned. He made no bones about it. He did not deny his dependence upon his Father. It was always there. And when these people would accuse him, he'd run behind his Father's skirt more or less. He said, wait a minute, you're not rejecting me, you're rejecting him who sent me. And when they rejected his words, he said, wait a minute, you're not rejecting my words, you're rejecting the words of the Father. He's told me what to say. And when you accept them, you accept me and you accept him then in return. And if you reject them, you reject me and you reject him in return. He always connected himself with his Father. So there are three things, and there's one more. First of all, he knew, and he relates here in these five chapters, these few hours, he tells about this close, personal, intimate relationship with his Father. He lets us hear and tell, he tells us about his love for his Father. He then shows us his dependence upon his Father. And then finally, jumping up off the page, I guess more times than anything else that I found this, what you would call this anticipation to go home and be with his Father. Man, I kept seeing that thing recur all through this. 10 times in about 5 hours, Jesus kept bringing up the subject, I'm going home, I'm going home. 10 times in 5 hours. Say, for example, you went home with somebody to supper one night. That's what happened here. They all got together for supper. And they had perhaps 4 hours there at the table, and then, I don't know, that's a pretty long time for a meal. But see, there was 4 or 5 hours here between, I think that's about how much it includes. What if you went home with somebody, got there about 6 o'clock and stayed till about 10 or 11 o'clock, and 10 times they kept bringing up the subject, I'm going home. I'd get the impression, I believe they're homesick. I think Jesus was homesick. I think he wanted to go home. He says, and this very section opens up in the very first verse, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to go home. It says here, to depart out of this world to the Father. But that's the way the whole section begins, when Jesus knew that it was the time for him to go home. How many of you have been homesick? Boy, I have. Yes, you have too. Homesick, wanting to go home. They advised me at this youth forum this last year, we were going to call it Let's Go Home. They said, don't say that. There's so many kids here that are homesick. Don't call it that. Want to go home. Be way over somewhere, plumb out of the country, and way thousands of miles from your mama and daddy, and you hear the green, green grass of home. Well, that's all you can do to stand it. Listen, Jesus, it says here, when he knew that the hour had come, it's time to leave. I'm on my way. And I'll tell you what, this thing surfaces and he never got rid of it. They never were able to quench it. They weren't able to squelch it. He kept talking about it. Listen to it. In 14, 2 and 3, he says, I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm going to my Father's house. In 14, 12, he says, truly I say to you, he who believes in me will also do the works that I do. And greater works than these will he do, because I go to the Father. I'm not going to read all of these, except that he just keeps telling them, I'm going to the Father. I'm going home. I'm going to the Father. He says, if you had loved me, you would have rejoiced when I told you that I was going to my Father. You would have rejoiced. And he keeps on and on and on, 10 times. He says, I'm going home. And then twice in his prayer, this is a part of the 10 times, but 2 of those 10 times was in his prayer when he said, Father, I'm coming to thee. I'm coming home. I cannot believe that he had never been there before. These things make me know that this man was going somewhere where he had already been. I'm going home. And so in these 50 times that we see Jesus using the term my Father or the Father, we see these four tremendous themes cropped out. His identity with his Father, it was a personal, very intimate relationship. His love for his Father came out. His dependence upon his Father emerges. And then this longing and anticipation to go home and be with his Father surfaces in a very graphic way. Now, what does it mean? It just simply means that as he taught others to be, so he was himself. He says, everything that you do must be done in the presence of your Father. And consequently, his life was meaningful. It was perfect. It was real. It was lived on a level far beyond anything we can expect. Unless perhaps we follow in his steps to a perfect degree and keep ourselves constantly aware of the presence of the Father. How many of you have been kept from lust by remembering my Father's with me? How many of you have been kept from anger and foul talk by knowing my Father's listening? How many of you have been kept pure on a date because you knew your Father was listening and was watching? I'll tell you one thing. I owe what little nobility or what little nobleness, if there's such a word, what little cleanliness, what little purity, what little holiness, I owe all of that. What little I possess, I owe it to this one simple thought. My Father is with me, and I do not want to disappoint him. And whatever I may be able to do from this podium, or person to person and house to house, whatever I'm able to do, it's done merely because of the awareness of the presence of the Father. And if I can keep my mind on that, I have unlocked power. But the moment I forget it, I'm gone. I know what he says here is true. Now let me conclude. I don't know whether all of us here are Christians or not. This has been spoken primarily as a conversation between the Father or between the Son, Jesus Christ, and his disciples. It was an intimate association. But there are those of you here tonight who are not Christians. Have you seen anything in what we've said, and perhaps over the last few weeks, have you seen anything that you want? Wouldn't you like to live in this kind of a relationship with the Creator of the universe? Wouldn't you like to be able to see into the center of the universe where all the power emanates from and where every source, where all the power finds its source and then holds the entire universe together? Would you like to see that? We're allowed to see it through seeing Jesus. He says, you know where I'm going. He was talking about going to the center of the universe, to his Father. That's what the center of the universe is. But you know, this is reserved only for those who are in Jesus Christ. No man can come to the Father except through me, he says. Only those that are in Jesus Christ. Are you in him? You say, I don't know. How can I tell whether I am or not? Very simply, here it is. If you believe with all of your heart that Jesus of Nazareth is what he claims to be, that he's the Son of the living God, if you're willing to turn your back on yourself and sin like he turned his back on physical life and gave it up for you, if you'll then turn your life over to him through repentance and be immersed in water for the forgiveness of your sins and be raised in him, with him, then you'll be in him. But you know, that's the only way you'll ever be in him. But that's one way. You don't need but one way. And he says, I am that way, the truth and the life. Oh, we urge you to come, and may you take what we've talked about tonight and may it minister to you in the sense of honing you if you're a Christian and preparing you further by being aware of your Father's presence and your relationship to him, by being aware of your dependence upon him and by being aware of your love for him and of an anxiety and an anticipation in the sense of an anticipation to go home and be with him. This will keep you and it'll get you there. We'd like for you to go with us, all of you. If you're not a Christian, we'd love for you to go with us. We don't want to leave you behind. We're going somewhere. The train is leaving. Would you like to go? Everything is prepared and everything is ready here, the water and the clothing. If you'd like to confess your faith and be immersed into him tonight, we extend that invitation. Won't you go with us while we stand and sing?
Against him.